You're listening to BreadboxMedia.com. The program is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin. I'm so happy to be here with you again. This is the second part of our examination of Hernando Cortez, the conquistador, who so many authors have berated and criticized, so many historians. And yet there's quite a bit more to the man than their criticisms, and many of the criticisms are inaccurate and ahistorical. We've been listening to descriptions of the expeditions of Cortez into what is now Mexico. And we had gotten as far in part one, to the point where Cortez had encountered the amazing woman, Doña Marina, who was to become so significant in his life. When he met her, she was one of a party of 20 women who were slaves that had been given to him by a group of Indians. But she had started life as the daughter of a wealthy chieftain who died, and the mother, to ensure the inheritance went to her son, sold Marina into slavery. Marina was to convert and be baptized, and she became a very devout Catholic. She was quite intelligent, tall, beautiful, regal even, and an excellent linguist. She became Cortez's chief translator, and his close confidant, his advisor, his ambassador, and finally, his lover. And they had a child. They never married. The child was to grow up and have a distinguished career under his father, and later on his own. The relationship of Cortez and Doña Marina was long and felicitous. We now begin to address the most important phase of Cortez's career in Mexico. Because Cortez now, where we take him up again, is about to go into the interior of Mexico, where he will go to the capital city, which is now Mexico City, then called Tenochtitlan, the most advanced city in the world, a place of splendor, beauty, cleanliness, and order. There's much to praise about the technological achievements of the Aztec Empire, but there's much to criticize about their religion, because the religion, as in most successful cultures, was the force, the fuse that drove the culture, that drove the politics, that drove the daily lives, the economy. It starts with a cult and the culture. It's all downstream from the culture, even in our own time. Why did Cortez view the Aztecs' religion as so satanic, as so disreputable and contemptible? Well, we would view it so today, because it was based on a ritualistic human sacrifice. Sometimes great numbers of people were sacrificed in a single festival. Tens of thousands. The heart was cut out. The blood flowed down the steps of the temple, which literally were stairways of blood. Those beautiful temples that we see today, it's hard to imagine what they must have been like. But so we don't get lost, let's step back and take an overview for a minute. Not just Cortez, but the world at this time. What was going on? The Catholicism stretched from Europe into the New World, Africa and the Orient at this time. Helmsmen with grand dreams and unlikely maps took ships where no European memory existed. Where no European memory existed. They packed priests aboard, soldiers and adventurers on the voyages that could lead to death, disease, and destruction, or glory. And some of the sailors were not so rough-hewn. On many ships like those of Columbus, they observed the liturgy of the hours, like monks chanting them, and they refrained from cursing and drunkenness. They were a more virtuously Catholic group than the term sailor implies to our modern ears. The explorations began with Henry the Navigator, who was Portuguese. He was before Columbus. He devoted himself to the exploration of Western Africa. He sought a person called Prester John, a mythical Christian king. The existence of this Catholic kingdom under Priester John was all a myth, based on a forged letter that had been delivered to the Emperor Constantinople. Priester John's Catholic kingdom was originally thought to be east of today's Iraq and Iran. But when that area was thoroughly explored and mapped, they realized that it was not there, and it was transferred in the vivid imaginations of the time to Africa, to East Africa. And so Henry the Navigator was searching for Priester John, who did not exist. But Henry the Navigator did penetrate into previously unexplored areas down the coasts of Africa and succeeded in making his country of Portugal an imperial power with an empire. But the lure of great profits and treasure depraved the Portuguese character. Portugal became a leader in the slave trade, muscling in on a business that was previously monopolized by Muslims from the desert in Animas in Black Africa. There hadn't been slave owners in Africa or people involved in the slave trade since slavery had been banned by Catholic emperors in late Roman Empire in the 400 and 500s. Now, Europeans had been taken as slaves. However, a European slave owner was a great rarity. For over 1,000 years, a fact not generally known, it was the explorations and the discovery of new worlds that brought the practice of owning slaves back to Europeans. Portugal also became a leader in cartography and naval science. Henry the Navigator himself encouraged the study of mathematics and medicine, things that would aid his explorers, and he sent missionaries into West Africa, an area that would later be known as the White Man's Grave because of malaria and other disabilities of its climate. Following in Henry's wake was Bartolomeu Dias, who found the Cape of Good Hope. Then came Spain, when in 1492 the last remnant of the Muslims was driven from España. That same year, Christopher Columbus, an Italian captain, pledged himself to the service of Spain's King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella to find a new route to the riches of India. Instead, he found the American continents were in the way, though he never confessed as much, insisting that these were, in fact, outcroppings of the Orient and that the natives were, quote, Indians. Another Italian who sailed at different times for Portugal and Spain, Amerigo Vespucci. Amerigo. America is named after him. So Amerigo finally set the course of Iberia straight on what they had discovered. And a Spaniard, Vasco Nunez de Balboa, found that on the other side lay the vast Pacific Ocean. The sea route to India, meanwhile, was usually found by another Portuguese, Vasco da Gama, who, following the route of Bartolomeu Dias around South Africa, then continued up Africa's east coast and across to India. Through the work of Columbus and da Gama, the Catholic Church gained a foothold on both the Indian subcontinent and in the New World. Catholic missionaries ranged from the Azores to the ports of West Africa, South Africa, East Africa, to Aden, Portuguese India, the islands of the Far East, and in various places in China. With the explorers came conquerors, the new crusaders, the conquistadors. They were men like Juan Ponce de Leon, who put the Spanish ashore at Florida, at Sanibel, and near St. Augustine. Francisco Pizarro, who defeated the Incas, seized Peru, defeating a dictator who had only been in power for 6 or 7 months, who had seized power from an earlier dictator who had been only a few years. I'm emphasizing that we perceive the European conquerors as conquering peoples that had been long established and empires that had been long established. That's not the case everywhere. Immigrants to the New World came in waves, conquering and exterminating those who preceded them. This is not a sin that is peculiar to Europeans. It's a human sin. And finally, today we're talking about Hernando Cortez, who comes into the picture at this point, toppling the Aztecs and conquering Mexico, bearing as his standard the motto of Constantine, In hoc signo vinces. In other words, the motto means, under the sign of the cross we conquer. Soldiering with Cortez was Bernal Diaz, whose remarkable account, The Conquest of New Spain, detailed how a relative handful of Spaniards, nearly all lacking guns, armor, or horses, routinely thrashed thousands of Indians at a time. Spanish victories were marked by a cleansing, a literally whitewashing, of the blood-stained temples of the Aztec human sacrifice. The temples were then converted to Catholic churches or shrines to the Virgin Mary. The Aboriginal natives were lectured and convinced, finally, that the days of ritual human sacrifice, cannibalism, and the feeding of human beings to wild beasts in their vast zoos were over. The conquistadors respected the Aztec chieftain, Montezuma, the Saladin of these New World Saracens. But it says something, too, that the Spaniards were able to enlist the other tribes of Mexico as allies against the Aztecs in a conquest that began in 1519 and was fully accomplished only three years later. Spanish priests not only quickly established churches, but turned their hands and minds to constructing towns, aqueducts, hospitals, 4,000 hospitals within the first 10 years, in every little town. And also schools for the natives. They also taught themselves the native languages and in turn taught the natives Latin, among other subjects. But from the beginning in New Spain, the church, while often working hand in glove with representatives of the Spanish crown, found itself battling for the rights of the Aboriginal Americans against the abuses of the conquistador states. Well, it's time for a break, so stand up and dance around the couch before you lay down again and go on listening. This is Setting the Record Straight with Chuck Coughlin on Breadbox Media.
You're listening to Breadbox Media. Find out more at breadboxmedia.com.
You're listening to breadboxmedia.com. The program is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin. And we were talking about Cortez and listening to some of Cortez's words and others of his contemporaries, like Bernal Diaz, the amateur historian but very capable one. Diaz was one of his soldiers. And we were hearing that the Catholic Church was encouraging and commanding, actually, the Spanish colonists to behave better with respect to the Indians, to not enslave them, to treat them humanely, actually, to treat them as well as they would treat themselves. What could be more Catholic than that? In 1537, at papal command, all Aboriginal natives living in Spanish colonies were guaranteed equal rights as fellow communicants in the Catholic Church. Under unstinting pressure from the Mexican bishop, Bartolomé de las Casas, we often talk about him, who had arrived in the New World with Columbus, was supported by Queen Isabella, very, very strongly supported. The use of these Native Americans as slaves was officially forbidden by Spanish law. If the slavery of the natives was thus curtailed on the margins, the practice continued, in fact, in defiance, at a high cost of the natives' life, though by far the higher cost came from the natives' exposure to Western diseases like smallpox. Labor shortfalls were made up with slaves imported from Africa. Churchmen admonished the soldier conquerors that abuse of these native people, however primitive they might seem, would endanger the salvation of the Spaniards themselves. Spanish friars in the New World continually warned the conquistador rulers that the Indians, even the non-Catholic Indians, who sometimes seemed too dense to grasp the Catholic faith, were protected by Christ's admonition to treat one's neighbor as oneself. In 1531, that truth was underlined in a shocking way. 1531. Do you remember what happened then? The Virgin Mother appeared as a mestizo, a mixed blood, an American Aborigine mixed with Spanish blood. The Virgin Mary appeared to a poor peasant native, telling him she wanted a church built where she stood as proof of her instruction and her identity. She imprinted her image on the peasant Serafi so he could take it to the skeptical local bishop. That very Serapi now hangs in the church that was built on the spot. It is there. Given the superiority the conquering Spaniards felt over their native subjects, it is surprising that the Spaniards themselves accepted the miracle and worshipped at a shrine to a Mestizo Mary. Unless they honestly believed in the apparition, they obviously did. The Marian vision certainly had an enormous evangelical result. There had not been a great number of converts among the native people prior to this apparition. It is estimated that 8 million Mexicans were baptized over the next 7 years because of it. 8 million. The monarchs behind Spain's expansion were Ferdinand and Isabella. Isabella was a woman of the highest Catholic character. She's often just called the Catholic. Now, Ferdinand was another hard man, more feared than loved and admired by Machiavelli. He had one obvious testimonial. He took a divided nation of separate kingdoms, partially occupied by the Muslims, and unified it and made it a world power. No small achievement. So we can see that here on the eve of the Protestant Reformation in Europe that was to tear the world apart, that a great age of exploration and discovery occurred, and carried with it a great evangelical spreading of the Catholic faith that brought the world together. Columbus and Cortes and the rest brought the old and new world together. Well, we're fortunate in having the good objective Catholic scholarship so characteristic of it through the centuries and recording what the people really thought that they were evangelizing. What was the cult of the Aztecs like? The Aztecs believed they were indispensable partners of the gods in preserving the unity and harmony of the cosmos. They had to do their part. As the sun god daily warred against the moon god and star gods, it was the Aztecs' sacred duty to nourish the sun god. I'll try to do his name, Huitzilopochtli. Do I hear you laughing? Please don't. That's the best I can do. Let's just use the English version of that name, the hummingbird wizard. They had to strengthen this god in this battle. The very survival of the world depended on it. And the sun god was on a strict diet. Blood, human blood. The result was human sacrifice, not just in Mexico City, but virtually every village in Mexico and beyond. In every village in Mexico stood a temple of varying sizes, somewhat resembling pyramids in Egypt. You've seen the pictures. The lower parts of the temples often were tombs for departed aristocrats. There were steps up the side, and at the top was a flat surface on which rested a chapel-like structure. When the time for the sacrifice came, the victim was led up, or victims, there were many, were led up the temple stairs and laid facing upwards on a slab of rock. The priest then used an obsidian knife to slash open his chest, pull out his still beating heart, and hold it up, still palpitating before the sun god. The victim was then decapitated and his body was rolled down the temple steps, where the people dismembered it and cannibalized its flesh. They had huge stew pots at the base of these, surrounding the base of these four-sided temples. The historian Caso explains the significance of Aztec cannibalism. I'll quote him. Aztec cannibalism was a rite performed as a religious ceremony, so much so that he who had captured a prisoner could not eat his flesh because the captive was looked upon as his son. It should not be forgotten that in the minds of the Aztecs, the human victims were the very incarnation of the gods whom they represented and whose attire they wore. And when they ate their flesh, they were performing a kind of communion with the divinity. At other times, during ceremonies in the honor of the god Zipe, the prisoner was tied to the upper part of a kind of framework and then riddled by arrows until he died. The blood spilling on the ground was thought to make it fertile and thus stimulate, by sort of a magical sympathy, the fall of the other precious liquid, rain. There was another type of sacrifice for Zipi and the goddess of the earth. In this rite, the victim was flayed and the priest dressed in his skin. Decapitation and burning were also used as methods of sacrifice. There was another type of sacrifice, gladiatorial sacrifice.
This consisted of a real duel between a prisoner captain and several of the most distinguished Aztec warriors, two of whom must be knights of the military Order of the Eagles and two of the Order of the Jaguars. It wasn't an equal fight, however, since the captain was bound and had to defend himself with only a wooden sword, with small tufts of downy feathers attached to its edges instead of obsidian blades. The captive fought with one knight at a time. If the first should be defeated, another would take up the battle. In spite of his inferior weapons, if the captive succeeded in vanquishing the four knights, a fifth who was left-handed generally killed him. There is a story about one warrior, Tlahuicol, who did succeed in defeating all five of the knights and was consequently pardoned. Children were sacrificed to Tiahuac, the rain god. The more they cried, the more likely their tears were to induce rain. Caso, who has described all this, is director of archaeology at the National Museum of Mexico. He casually and objectively records all of this and more. Then, amazingly, in the only real moral judgment of the entire book, Caso calls the Spanish conquest, quote, a sad event, for the Aztecs' way of life was no longer to follow its own course. An alien world had come to impose its views upon these people and their civilization. That's a rather strange observation, isn't it? Civilization, way of life? Savagery and way of death would be more appropriate. In the year 1487, shortly before the arrival of the Spanish, a man named Huitzotl, Montezuma's immediate predecessor, dedicated the great temple to the sun god and sacrificed 20,000 victims, who stood in four long lines, stretching between 3 and 4 miles long, and the ceremony lasted 4 days and was conducted by 8 teams of priests. The sacrifices escalated from that point and may have reached 50,000 per year, some say higher. The historian John M. White says, when we visit or study photographs of Aztec temples, we should picture to ourselves those tall staircases as they frequently appeared, covered from top to bottom with a tacky crimson sheath of blood. This practice of human sacrifice, as I said earlier, worked to the Aztec detriment. Not only did they sacrifice many of their own warriors, maidens, and children, and deplete their own resources, but by demanding human captives for sacrifice from other nations, they incurred the wrath of their own vassal states and the undying hostility of those beyond their control. Many of these nations held beliefs and practices similar to those of the Aztecs, but if their warriors were to be sacrificed, it should be to their own gods and on their own altars, not far away in Tenochtitlan, by the hated Aztecs. Cortes thus found ready allies in his conquest of the Aztecs. This is the central issue. He found ready allies. The Aztecs were hated. The Native Americans looked upon Cortes not as a conqueror, but as Cortes the liberator. The Aztec practice of human sacrifice galvanized the Spaniards into action. They found the practice grotesque, repulsive, and against the laws of God and man. But it was more than that. As seasoned soldiers, they were used to bloodshed, but these were more than just acts of violence. They were rituals performed for a satanic god. The conquistadors believed in God fiercely and unreservedly. But they believed also, above all else, in the devil. The arrival of Hernan Cortes was an arrival of the one who would set them free, of Cortes the Liberator. This is Setting the Record Straight. We'll be back after the break.
Redbox Media, now is a great way for you to go deeper with your favorite show or shows in our programming lineup. With our Friend of the Show opportunity, you get extra exclusive content from your favorite show hosts and lots of extra love from the shows and hosts you love. Become a friend of the show by clicking on the link on our website or app menu. Your $10 monthly premium membership will unlock an exclusive world just for you. Support your favorite show today as a friend of the show. Friend of the Show premium memberships exclusively for you with Redbox Media.
You're listening to BreadboxMedia.com. The program is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin. So we were describing the satanic gods of the Aztecs and how horrified the Spaniards were by the practice of human sacrifice. Because the sacrifices they sought was a sacrifice to Satan, to the devil. And they were very familiar with the devil. Now, in this day and age, where we don't speak of the devil very often, do we? We go to church and we speak of God all the time. What about the reality of Satan, of Lucifer? The New World, in other words, was the empire of Satan. Satan was a devil with a multiform face, always hideous. The somber Mexican divinities, the sorcerer hummingbird, and the smoking mirror, and the horrible Kinishkamo of the Mayas, the Peruvian Viracocha,
who was symbolized by boiling lava,
and the sinister totems
of the
Araucanians and the Aiguites.
Why, back in Europe, the Spanish medieval
demon with short horns, lustful eyes, and a tail that was curled like a vine shoot seemed like a good devil besides such as these. Spaniards, who in their boyhood had taken the flight of a bat for the passing of the evil one, were naturally terrified before these monsters of stone with bared fangs and gleaming eyes that seemed to come to fantastic life as night fell. How could they have watched an Aztec ceremony without nausea? The black-robed priests with their matted hair burrowing with their knives in the breasts of their victims, the human skulls piled up at the feet of the temple,
the cannibal feasts around the statues,
spattered with putrid blood, and the charnel house stench which all the perfumes of Mexico were never able to hide. Such things froze the spirits of the conquistador, surpassing the nightmares of their childhood. Satan himself was there, and his worship was celebrated among the dismembered corpses. I must apologize for these terrible word pictures, but they're real. And to understand Cortez and understand the Spaniards, these few hundred, we have to understand the place and the time and what it was like. Here in Mexico, Satan was no longer a familiar accomplice that could be driven off by a flick of the finger or by the shameful specter slipping furtively through one's conscience, but put to flight by a simple sprinkling of holy water. No, here he was enthroned, carved in granite, encrusted with precious stone, and encircled with golden serpents. He was the superb incarnation of evil. He glorified sin. Nothing was lacking in this perfect representation of hell, not even the pots in which certain tribes of the Colombian jungle cooked their enemies alive. This indeed was Satan himself, adorned with all his lugubrious attractions. So why are we astonished at the reactions of the Spaniards? In the depths of the Indian sanctuaries, they could see the Prince of Darkness. Looking to the heavens, they could distinguish the silvery figure of St. James galloping across the clouds. The conflict between the true and the false, good and evil, it was manifest here in this double apparition. The problem was simple and their duty was clear. These people were possessed by the devil, who had to be exorcised, first by destroying the material evidence of devil worship. That is why the conquerors activated by the same blind zeal as the early Catholics, when they shattered the Roman statues, they overturned the pre-Columbian idols and burned the ritual articles and the manuscripts that transmitted this horrendous sacred tradition. In short, showed in holy order to abolish the very memory of this heathen liturgy. These acts they counted as pious work. Iconoclasts, vandals, these epithets would have scandalized the conquistadors. Who would have applied such words except the agents of Satan who served as a vile master? If after the Second World War we felt the urge to bulldoze down the death camps in Germany, would that be an act of vandalism? Would we be iconoclasts? You see, in order that the exorcism be fully effective, it was not enough to drive away the demon. It was also proper to set up in their places the symbols of the true faith. Just as holy medals are laid upon the flesh that was eaten away with ulcers, the soldiers of Charles V planted crosses on tops of the temples or at crossroads. What about the stones that were still spattered with blood? On these they raised altars to Our Lady of Guadalupe. Tolerance was not for them. Others would follow who would use gentler methods.
No one doubts that these booted and armored Catholics often lacked the true Catholic spirit, and that charity was almost always missing from their fervor. Their faith and their good intent were whole. More than ever, the love of God and one's neighbor, the horror of Satan, explains certain of the conquistadors' attitude. Though, of course, it is understood that to explain is not to absolve them.
When we examine the character of Montezuma, it's quite apparent, and it's extensively documented, that he had become an obsessed, blood-drenched, superstitious man whose decisions were dictated by demonic powers rather than God or human reason. Another aspect of the Aztec religion worked to the detriment of the empire. That was the legend of Quetzalcoatl. The Quetzalcoatl legend abounds throughout Central America. As the Aztecs conquered other nations and absorbed their gods into their own polytheistic pantheon, the Quetzalcoatl stories became more varied and complex. Essentially, Quetzalcoatl was the feathered serpent, the god of goodness, and also the god of wind and morning star. He's the god of light who stands against the evil god Tezcatlipoca, god of darkness, and patron of evil, and the two are in perpetual conflict. But Quetzalcoatl is also a man, was a man, or at least a god who appeared as a man, possibly an early Toltec king or priest. He is described in some of the Quetzalcoatl legends as having white hair and a beard, blue eyes, and a light complexion. Rather strange. Eventually, he was forced by political intrigue to leave Mexico, largely because he fought against human sacrifice, and sailed off into the east on a raft of snakes, promising to return to his people at a time of great oppression and adversity. When Montezuma learned of the landing of Spaniards on the east coast of Mexico, he felt that Quetzalcoatl had returned. He shuddered, for that meant his reign was over. The gods had willed it, and it would come to pass. Man but was an instrument in the hands of the gods, unable to control his own destiny. Many of the native aborigines on the east coast of Mexico also believed that perhaps Quetzalcoatl had returned. Quetzalcoatl had returned and rejoiced that the generations of Aztec oppressions were drawing to a close. In the person of Cortez, Quetzalcoatl had returned to set his people free. You see, is Cortez the liberator, not the conquistador, the liberator. Signs and portents pointed to the return of Quetzalcoatl and the end of Aztec rule. So this mythical liberator, Cortez Quetzalcoatl, had departed for Mexico from Cuba in February of 1519. He had 11 ships, 500 native Spanish soldiers, 100 sailors, 16 horses. There were no horses in the New World. They were unknown before the Spaniards arrived. He had 32 crossbows, 13 muskets, 4 little small cannons called falconets, and a few slightly larger cannons. With this tiny force, Cortez, who they thought to be Quetzalcoatl, intended to conquer an empire of millions. His close advisor, confidant, and mistress, and beloved woman, Marina, had advised him, describing thoroughly just how big the empire was and how big the army was. He knew what he was up against. Yet he didn't believe he was on a suicide mission. Anybody else would have. If there was ever a brilliant general, if there ever was a courageous man, it was Hernan Cortes, and his courage was from God, and from his belief in God was the fire and fuse that supported his courage. Were there ever men of such daring? Is what Diaz had said. On his banners were these words, "Brothers and companions, let us follow the sign of the cross, and in it we shall conquer. In hoc signe vinces." He landed in Montezuma's territory in April. Good Friday to Christians. But to the Aztecs, it was the year one reed, the day nine wind. The Quetzalcoatl legend had predicted the hero's return, not only in the year one reed, but on his own name day, Quetzalcoatl's name day, nine wind. That's when Cortez landed. Was he Quetzalcoatl? Quetzalcoatl had worn black since it was Good Friday. Cortez was dressed in black. The Aztec records tell us that Montezuma believed that Cortez was Quetzalcoatl. He sent ambassadors with gifts. The records also tell us that Montezuma was plunged into gloom and sorrow. Perhaps two reasons combined to cause his despair. He knew that Quetzalcoatl had abhorred human sacrifice, and it would now be suppressed. Yet Montezuma believed that the existence of his people depended on human sacrifice to feed the god. And he, Montezuma, had presided as emperor over tens of thousands of human sacrifices each year. Quetzalcoatl is coming. When his ambassadors returned and gave their report, Montezuma's despair turned into terror. They described the strangers as dressed in iron, swords, bows, shields, spears of iron. The report said, "They're deer, these war horses. Carry them on their backs wherever they wish to go. These deer, our lord, are as tall as the roof of a house. Their dogs are enormous. Their eyes flash fire and shoot off sparks. They are tireless and very powerful."
Perhaps, like us, Montezuma needs a break. If he could only have a few minutes of peace like you're going to have. Before Setting the Record Straight returns with what happens next. Setting the Record Straight on Cortez the Liberator, redboxmedia.com.
No me vaya la zorrera, mira que me está cayendo una agüita calajera. Mira que te está cayendo una agüita calajera, una agüita calajera.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media, get the app, change the world.
Don't be afraid, we're back after the break. It's only us setting the record straight with that mild webcasting network, redboxmedia.com. What a homey name, wonderful. But not everybody's comfortable, are they? Hope you are. Cowering in the darkness of his palace, Montezuma dreads the coming of Quetzalcoatl. It's only Cortez. But he's a superstitious man. And this being, dressed in black, alighted in Mexico in the year one reed, on the very day, Nine Wind, that was the name day of Quetzalcoatl, that he predicted he would return. Quetzalcoatl is coming. In his terror, Montezuma wanted to keep the Spaniards out of Tenochtitlan at all costs. He sent them gifts, asking them to go no farther. His witch doctors worked spells to keep them in their place. Cortez was unaffected by gifts or spells. He made allies with a nearby tribe, which was eager to be freed from Aztec domination, Cortez the Liberator.
He got his men's vote at their assent to create a town where their encampment was, a Spanish municipality, and he named it Villa Rica del Veracruz, rich town of the True Cross, Veracruz. It is still named Veracruz. And took possession of Mexico in the name of Charles I of Spain. He built a fort, assigned a third of his men to it. The rest of the army marched inland. Cortez ordered 9 of his 10 ships scuttled. He wanted to leave no temptations to desertion or retreat to the men he was leaving behind. He then told his men that those who were afraid of the coming battle could take the 10th ship back to Cuba. No one did. So Cortez scuttled the last ship as well.
As this demonstrate, and you can well see, Cortez was capable of a grand gesture. Many grand gestures. He was incredibly bold. When tremendously outnumbered and the enemy attacking, he would urge his men to go on in feverish and intense attack, as if they did not fear death. He inspired them so that they did it. And then again and again they won, outnumbered 10-1, 100-1, even 1,000-1. They were victorious. They were bold and victorious. Then he took 300 Spaniards. So he had no quitters and cowards. They wanted to return back to Spain, so he burnt the 10th ship. And then, speaking to his men with tremendous power and fervor,
He led them inland and marched inland to face an empire of 15 million that had an advanced army of 3 million. Bernal Diaz, Cortes' faithful soldier and chronicler, writes, "Let the curious reader see whether there is not much to ponder over this in which I venture to write, and whether there was ever in the universe men who had such daring." Wow, they were courageous. The Spaniards marched toward Tenochtitlan. Quetzalcoatl was coming. Montezuma, still paralyzed by fear, did nothing to stop them. They reached Xocotlan, whose chief was allied to Montezuma. In the center of the town was a temple where sacrifices regularly occurred. There were racks of human skulls. Because there were uneven rows, it was easy to count them. According to de Bernal Diaz, our number might be 100,000. And I say again, Bernal wrote, 100,000? Bernal did not have italics, but 100,000 might have been underlined. Then Cortes marched into the territory of Tlaxcala. The Tlaxcala had maintained their independence, though many of their warriors had been captured in battles with the Aztecs, and their hearts fed to the devil gods. Cortes sent Indian allies to negotiate a treaty, but the Tlaxcalans did not trust them. They attacked. Cortes and his men were facing odds of 100 to 1. But even aided by the few horses and few guns that the Spaniards had brought with them, one would think they had no chance of overcoming 100 to 1. Nevertheless, the Spaniards won. It has been said that the Spaniards at this time were perhaps the best fighting men the world has ever known. This was only the first of many battles on this expedition, which tempts you to believe that statement. But nearly every man was wounded, and many said it would be better to return to the coast, send for reinforcements. Cortes replied, "The greater the obstacles, the greater the glory." Listen to Cortes. "We are obligated to exalt and increase our holy Catholic faith, which we undertook to do like good Catholics, uprooting idolatry, that great blasphemy to our God, abolishing sacrifices and the eating of human flesh, which is so contrary to nature and so common here." You see, Cortes never lost sight of the primary purpose of his expedition, the destruction of the devil gods and the conversion of Mexico to the Catholic faith, to win Mexico for the reign of Christ the King. The Tlaxcalans now asked for Cortes for a treaty specifying an alliance which would be crucial to his expedition. He converted one of their temples into a church, and Father Olmedo, the chaplain of the expedition, said his mass there. About this time, Cortes sent a letter, we still have it, requesting supplies. You know what Cortes requested for his battle? Here's the supplies. He wanted hosts and altar wine. He knew that far more than crossbows and muskets, his men must be armed with the body and blood of Jesus Christ. This was a real Catholic. In the next stop, in the middle of October, was Cholula, where still stood a temple to Quetzalcoatl. Legend has it that any army which did not believe in the Aztec gods would be drowned by a torrent of water from the pyramid. The Choluans did not believe that Cortes was Quetzalcoatl. Neither by this time did most of the Aztec leaders. To his great credit, Cortes insisted to everyone that he was not a god, that he was a man, at all times. He didn't feed the legend, setting the record straight on that. He insisted he was a man. Apparently, on advice from Aztec ambassadors, the Cholulans prepared an ambush for Cortes and his men. But the night before the planned ambush, the chief's wife came to Cortes' ambassador and interpreter, Donna Marina, his beloved Marina, with whom he had a child. The chief's wife warned Marina about the plot so she would not be caught in it and would marry the chief's son when it was all over. Marina pretended to go along with the woman and extracted all the information she could. And then she went to Cortes and told him. The next morning, Cortes and his men were prepared.
Thanks to Donna Marina.
They set upon the Cholulans and prevailed over them after a 5-hour battle.
Some critics of Cortez have accused him of massacring helpless natives, but these natives were armed and prepared for a fight because they themselves had been planning to massacre the helpless Spaniards. In the course of the battle, the idol in the temple was thrown down. On the top, a stone cross was erected. There was no deluge of water from the pyramid, and Cortez and his men marched on.
Back in Tenochtitlan, in his palace,
Montezuma was terrified. He ordered more human sacrifices to help him decide what to do. His council finally invited the Spaniards to enter Tenochtitlan. And so on Tuesday, November 8th, in a grand procession, they marched onto the causeway that led across the lake to Cactus Rock, the city of the devil gods.
Cortez the Liberator had come to Tenochtitlan. During the first days of Cortez's stay at Tenochtitlan, Montezuma was a gracious host. He gave the Spaniards a palace to live in and servants to wait on him. Cortez tried to explain Catholicism to Montezuma and urged him to worship the one true God, but Montezuma told him not to speak of such things. In November, Montezuma took Cortez and his men on a tour of the marketplace and the great temple. Near the temple was a building in the form of a theater with towers on both ends. The walls, steps, benches, and towers were constructed entirely of mortar and human skulls. Then Montezuma allowed Cortez and some of the men to see the images of the two gods. Bernal Diaz described them. On each altar there were two statues, as of giants and very fat. And first on the right side, they say, was that of witchy wolves. Huitzilopochtli, witchy wolves. And round his necks, they said witchy wolves was wearing some native faces and some hearts of natives, some of gold, some of silver. And there were the hearts of three natives, which they had sacrificed that day and were burning. And the walls of that chapel were so steep black with crusts of blood, and the floor also, that it stank very badly. It was a charnel house. The other big image was the god of hell, Tezcatlipoca. And he was in charge of the souls of the victims. And close to his body he had some figures like small devils, with tails like serpents. And on the walls so much blood, and also the floor was soaked in blood.
So wrote Bernal Diaz. After they climbed down from the pyramid, Cortez asked Montezuma's permission to build a chapel in the palace where they were staying. Permission was granted. The chapel was built with a cross and an image of the Blessed Virgin Mary, and Mass was said there every day. Cortez fully realized the dangerous position he and his men were in. Soon, whatever remaining illusions Montezuma had about Cortez would dissolve. He would be sure that he was a man and not Quetzalcoatl.
And with that realization, it was certain that Montezuma would order an attack upon Cortez the Liberator, the devout Catholic.
Praying daily, praying devoutly, in his chapel in the palace of the capital city of Tenochtitlan. Listen to part three tomorrow and see what happens next. You might be amazed. This is Setting the Record Straight on Breadbox Media. Listening to Cortez, Chuck Coughlin.